right, it's Sunday night. It is 10 p.m. Central Standard Time, 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you are listening to The Ooze with your hosts, T.C. Downey and Jason Sorrell. T.C., what's going on, man? How you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well, man, actually. Kicking back, mellow. There's a real nice breeze blowing through, blowing through every which direction from what I can tell. It's been pretty strong, actually. It keeps blowing my curtains out and knocking shit all over. So if you hear shit crash during the show, it's just because there's a good breeze going here in Clearwater, Florida this evening.
What is colder than fuck here in Austin, Texas? I say that having been acclimated to Texas weather. So, you know, here it's getting down to 40 degrees. It's not like back in Indiana when, you know, zero was cold as fuck. Here, when it's cold for me to be in my shorts, that's too damn cold, or too cold for me to be in my shorts, it's too damn cold. So that's what we're dealing with here in Texas right now, is a nice chill in the air, which means that today, during our little Gluttony Day celebration here, it made the whole baking and everything convenient because we got to kind of heat the place up using the oven.
Right on. So it was two birds with one stone type deal. I like that.
Right on. Yeah. So we had the big meal, the big family, you know, chow down basically. We roasted a bird and had all the sides, a ridiculous number of sides, every side you can imagine, I think. Three or four different types of desserts, and just celebrated the typical, the real secular fashion, basically. Not being necessarily thankful for anything that we had or what have you. We feel like, we should be thankful or glad for your own success and your own ability to, you know, get your own things and do these things and share in your abundance every day. But Gluttony Day for us, Thanksgiving is an opportunity to just express and demonstrate the abundance that we have. You know, so it's the taking time off to, you know, to actually do it shows that you have the ability to actually take time off. And then, of course, having the food and having, you know, everything around, again, just, you know, just the abundance. And every year seems like we end up with a new tradition, something that we know that we're going to be doing a year on from that point forward. This year, Jamie and I, we broke up the wine glasses. We're going to have a glass of wine with our dinner. And our six-year-old, she wanted in on the toast. Now all the kids will be in on the toast from now on. So that'll be the new thing for us. So pretty good day.
Corrupting them early. I like that.
Yeah.
See, what I find interesting about that, like I grew up in an Irish-American family. So as soon as your ass could sit up without being in a high chair at the dinner table and, you know, eat your food without mom yelling at you 50 million times to do it, you were entitled to have whatever you wanted to drink with dinner. And that included the entire alcohol section of the cabinet as well. So it wasn't really a big thing to, you know, have a couple shots of whiskey. I happen to actually, stereotypical or slapstick funny as this is, I actually happen to have an affinity for a good whiskey, or more particularly a good bourbon. It developed around that age. It was actually something I looked forward to, was getting to sit down and have that shot of whiskey with my dinner that night. So that was my motivation for doing, you know, everything that needed to be done and getting my high marks or whatever with my mom throughout the day. So at the end there was, you've earned it. Go ahead, have your drink.
Right on. Well, you know, it's funny with our kids. Like today, Nadia, the six-year-old, she didn't have anything alcoholic to drink. She had a glass full of Fanta. But with my daughter, it's been a matter of if we're drinking something, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. It's beer, it's wine, hard liquor. You know, even if they're little kids, if they're like, you know, what are you drinking? What is that? Can I have some? Yeah, take a little sip of that. Tell me what you think. And my dad was like that with me pretty much, you know, with my brother and I. You know, yeah, take a sip of that. Tell me what you think. And what you learn as children is that more often than not, you don't like that. You know, unlike you and your bourbon, the girls, you know, they're like, oh, that doesn't, I don't like that at all. I have no interest in that. So now here they are, you know, getting into their teenage years and everything, and they're not interested. They don't go out and drink. They don't go out and party. My brother and I, again, we're pretty much the same way. Coming to understand, you know, what these things are, the mystery of it was gone. You know, so there's no interest in it necessarily. So we didn't really pursue it as hardcore as some of our friends did, some of our peers in high school did. So there's something to be said about letting kids try it out and make a decision for themselves.
Well, I completely agree with that, man. I kind of wanted to just point to there being an alternative, end game of that particular scenario. And then in that case, it's just it's not necessarily even that the kid, like, I mean, in my case, I've always liked bourbon, always liked whiskey. My brother, on the other hand, he wasn't real fond of alcohol at all the way up until, I don't know, his probably 16th, 17th birthday, and then suddenly it was something he was into. But what we did develop was this lack of, I don't know, the sense of it being taboo to have the drink. So it wasn't like an impulsive need to break that rule. So the same kind of thing applies where we all drink. I mean, I can go long periods without actually drinking at all. I mean, my last stretch was actually about 2.5 years, and that was just up until this, I don't know, last year that I've actually started to drink alcohol again, and I doubt that'll hold for too terribly long. There's one thing I found out that I really dislike about alcohol, and that's this thing called the hangover.
Right on.
That for me is the worst part. It's not like any other drug that I've done. Any other drug I've done, when I finally wake up from my sleep the next day, I've slept off whatever, you know, sickening effects might, you know, accompany it. But for whatever reason, man, when I get a fucking hangover, I just can't shake that shit.
Right on. Well, what you're saying about drinking, about not, you know, there's no taboo in it. It's like the kids in Europe. When I got over to Germany, man, I mean, here I am, 18 years old, you know, going to Germany, and it was going to be a big deal to be able to legally buy liquor. Now, you know, being able to legally buy it, of course, didn't stop us from drinking when we were back in high school or whatever. But, you know, the idea for a lot of the guys, for a lot of the soldiers, it was going to be cool that you could walk into a bar and order a beer, and it was going to be a big deal that you could do that. And some of them, you know, took to it like fish, basically, that every weekend they were getting slammed drunk. And the funny thing was is that the German kids that had been drinking since, you know, they were able to, you know, to hoist their stein up themselves, it wasn't the thing to do. It wasn't, you know, you drank beer because that's what you wanted to drink, but not because you were looking to get totally shit-faced. Now, these German cats, they knew how to party, man, and they would throw down, but it just wasn't as big a deal to them as it is to us. The same taboos, I mean, goes with anything, you know, any culture where it seems that you have a taboo of something, you have restrictions on something, the greater the interest is in, you know, pursuing those restrictions, of exploring those different taboos. So right on, man.
Yeah, and what's neat is that kind of nicely wraps us around to what you were suggesting pre us hitting live on the air that we might tackle today.
Right. I was thinking we could talk about morality. Or amorality. Two sides, relatively the same coin. There's immorality also. But want to talk about, you know, morality, moral codes, and the advantages and disadvantages of, you know, morality as well as amorality, and what it means to pursue an amoralistic viewpoint. So that's kind of what I wanted to kick around tonight. And if you're listening to the show, the phone number is 347-989-1371 if you want to call in with your viewpoints on morality or amorality, you know, opposed or pro or what have you. So,
right. I think the first thing is to, at least in my mind, is to kind of address the AM morality thing, the immorality, immorality, morality thing, and where I think that immorality and morality kind of work themselves out to be this really weird kind of axiomatic dichotomy. Amorality is, in my opinion, something completely without either quality.
Right, exactly, exactly. That morality is having a system that it's just there. It's a code of, you know, behavioral guidelines that define intentions, decisions, and actions that are either good when they are in line with that particular code, or bad when they are out of line with that particular code. Immorality is the active opposition of morality. So basically, if you're being immoral, you're still being defined by the moral code that you are acting against. You are, you know, you are still being, your behavior is still being guided by that particular system. Whereas if you are amoral, then you are indifferent. You don't care about the code. You're not interested in whether or not your behavior is with that particular code or opposed to that particular code. You're going by a different set of standards. So morality is not the mode by which you make your decisions.
Right, right on. And just as kind of an interesting side, speculation about this whole thing, I think that we as a species place entirely too much importance on behavior. I mean, I realize that to some extent behavior is how we figure things out. You know, behavior in itself is just sort of this repetitive pattern. Something does something and you can come to expect this something to continue to do it this way. But, I mean, the focus itself generally tends to, get a lot more abstract than what it really is.
Right on, right on. Where, yeah, it gets to, well, it's a convenient method for control. So when a kid goes to, sees fire for the first time, right, and goes to touch a flame and gets burned, okay, they learn quickly that's not something they should play with, at least not that manner. They shouldn't touch the fire because it hurts them. That's not a moral development. That's just a reaction from experience. It's a rational development. But then parents or society can use that same sort of idea that if you do X, you're going to get burned. So you don't do it because it's bad. It's bad for you. So, if you masturbate, you're going to get burned. If you vote a certain way, you're going to get burned, that kind of thing. So yeah, it becomes ambiguous, like you're saying, that one particular group. I mean, think about high school again. Think about these cliques and everything else. These girls running around cliques and everything. That if you were, they have their own moral code. They have their own behavioral standards, and they judge everything and everyone by those particular behavioral standards. And if you're outside that code, well, if they want you in their clique, they'll try to make sure that you conform to that particular code they live by and let you know that, this other behavior outside that code is bad. That if it, that if you go in this way, you'll be burned by, social stigma and being a pariah, at least as far as their clique's concerned, and things like that. Our whole society operates like that. And it comes down to the idea that we as a people, we as a society, we mature to a certain point. We become physically adults, but in many ways, spiritually and mentally, we're adolescents or children.
Right. I would agree with that entirely. The fact of it is, and kind of what I was getting at with my whole statement about the behavior, is that our focus is in changing that particular behavior rather than using that behavior as an identification tool. What I mean by this is you often can tell a person's intention by their behavior, but if they've been trained to behave a certain way, then their intention is sort of it's cloaked to you, if that makes sense.
Sure. Sure. No, that makes sense perfectly. It's just a matter of the majority of people in our society are their behaviors define who they are. So they have a certain identity that's been created. So you don't know who they are really. You just know based on what they do, you know, what to expect, what you can predict, you know, based on their behavior. Well, of course, if the behavior has been encoded in them from an outside source, then you know nothing about that person. You just know about the way that person's been trained.
Right. It's kind of like trying to judge a horse by how well it follows the blinders, or you know how much clearance it gets in the little. I can't even think what the fucking things they jump over are called now. Although it was in my mind like 2 seconds ago, but those things are certainly more indicative of what training they have gone through than they are actually of what characteristics that horse upholds.
Right on. Exactly. That you can't determine, like you're saying, if a horse is restricted by blinders, if a horse is tied to a carriage, then you're not going to know anything about that horse's speed. You're not going to know anything about the horse's ability to jump, or whether or not that horse, if acting on its own, would go in a straight line, would obey the commands of the riding cloth and the reins. You just know, you know, it's a poor way to try to understand that individual. You know, you'll know nothing about the horse itself. You just know about the role it's in at that time. That's particularly good when tied up to a carriage or to a coach and pulling that coach in a straight line.
Right on. Right. Yeah. I mean, what that does in my mind is kind of limit what potentials might really be there, not only from an internal aspect of observation, but also from an external aspect of observation. I mean, there's something to be said about peer review or peer suggestion, and if someone can say, "Hey, wait a minute, man," you know, just given what I know about you, you know, and not what I know that you do, but what I know about you, you might be particularly good in this field over here. And it might be something that this person would have never had the opportunity to really decide to look into if someone hadn't taken the time to get to know who they actually are and not just, you know, how they behave.
No, right on. Exactly. That, and we are, you know, we are a superficial society. So more often than not, we've been trained to make that mistake, that it's all about that facade that's presented to you because you're encouraged to define yourself by that same facade.
Yeah, that we are. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think it's necessary to kind of transgress all those limitations. When you find yourself, I want to say almost instinctively or just by like some force of habit, immediately opposed to something, and you can't, you know, put your finger on any kind of, I don't know, rational justification for it. More times than not, that's just something that you've been conditioned to be oppositional to.
Right. Definitely. And it takes some strength, I think, some strength of will to question the systems that have come to define you, to question the ideologies that have been put into you. And it is, it's a big red flag. When you approach something and you have just a kind of gut response to it, I mean, there's a difference between instinct and program. Don't get me wrong, but most of us have instincts that are so dulled by programming that more often than not, when we get that initial blush, that first blush reaction to whatever we're dealing with no rational, you know, reason behind it, then, yeah, we're dealing with something that has been instilled in us, programmed into us, and not something that we ourselves have determined to be true. So it's being defined by our moral system more often than not than amorality and being able to approach it rationally.
Right on. I mean, I think a good case in point would I could kind of point to myself. And I mean, I was taught my entire life because I was hard of hearing, you know, any kind of occupation and in a communications field or any type of actual public speaking would most likely result in some sort of failure. I mean, it was just kind of the way that I was conditioned to believe because of my particular disability, hearing loss. Who would have ever figured that after 3 long years of blog talk radio and YouTube and stuff like that, I still have that twitch before I get on the air every show, and I still, you get a little bit of the nervous apprehension that goes to it. But, I mean, I think as soon as the on-air thing clicks on, I pretty much let it roll after that.
Right on. I think there are a number of hot-button social topics that really are divisive when we're talking about our society, if you talk about abortion, if you talk about gay marriage, where people have a moral, opinion one way or the other. There are plenty of people who are pro-gay marriage without any real understanding of what it is they're for. They're out there voting and trying to win you over to their side of the argument just as much as there are people who are anti-gay marriage doing the same thing. And, of course, the limitations you learn about yourself, that I'm sure there are a lot of, people who, the women as a gender being told that they can't do X or Y or whatever it is, they can't do certain things. A lot of them come to believe it, or worse yet, not that they can't do certain things, but as a woman, that they shouldn't do certain things. So even when a woman is liberated mentally, even when she is, she's very much open and free with herself and how she behaves, there's still that part of her inside herself that has been taught that certain behaviors are bad. And even when she's engaged in those behaviors and she's thinking, I'm being liberated, there's still that part of her that tugs at her that makes her doubt herself. I've yet to find a woman who operates in many ways because they have it worse than men in our society, who operates on that free level, on that totally open and willful manner in which we men, the privileged gender, get to experience.
It's so funny to hear you to talk about it as if you're I don't know. It just kind of chuckles because I read your blog post this past week on the What the Hell Was I Thinking blog.
Sure.
Was that the right blog?
That was the one I posted. That's where I posted it. Whose sperm was stolen?
It's just funny because most people listening to the show might think that you're necessarily pro women's rights or whatever. But then if they were to go read that article, they would get the opposite impression. I guess what it kind of makes me laugh about it is for you, it seems to me that it's more about what makes sense versus, whether you stand on one particular side of one particular issue or the other.
Right. Well, that's the thing with that particular issue. It's about what's missing there. It's about equality. Okay, for me. And when you say equality to me, well, I look at what does the word mean? Well, it means equal. It means that both sides have the same expectations applied to them. Okay, so it's given that there is no equality, that equality doesn't exist, that equality is not real. But when you say to a group of people that, hey, as far as your rights are concerned, as far as legal precedent is concerned, as far as laws and how they're applied to you are concerned, we're going to be as equal as possible in the application of these laws. And then when you give one group or one gender a pass because they are of that group or of that gender – that you wouldn't give to everybody else, well, that's problematic in my mind. So I'm very much, and if you read that article, I think I even say this, I'm very much pro women's rights, that women, that women should have all the rights that they could possibly gain. They should be as equal to a man or any other gender out there as they could possibly be. but I also insist that they accept the same responsibilities. And that's the hang-up that most women, you know, step back from. You know, when you talk about even, you know, you're talking to a woman about going on a date with a guy, but she expects to be treated as an equal. She expects her ideas to be valued and cherished the same way that a man's ideas are. She expects to be able to, you know, speak her mind and say what she wants, and she expects to have a choice of doing, you know, whatever she wants after the date or during the date as she sees fit. But when that check comes over to the table, she fully has the expectation that he's going to pay the check because she's out on the date with him, and that's the role she's been given. Well, no, if it's equal, split the bill. You know, if it's equal and you want to pick up the check to just to make sure the date happens again, then pick up the check, but don't have that expectation. So,
Go ahead, man. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that's where women, you know, it's I'm all for equal rights, which means that, in my opinion, women are going to get burned or some shit.
Right. Well, I mean, the way that I kind of look at it is what we have here, anytime a particular group of people establishes, quote unquote, equal rights, they tend to, after that, kind of reach this phase of entitlement that just never seems to go away. They have this mentality that, you know, because they didn't go out there and just grab those rights, that somebody granted them their equal rights, that somebody should grant them everything else. And I think that's the kind of the trap that that whole thing leads to is that none of it should be granted. You shouldn't seek any kind of equality. Equality itself, in my opinion, equals stagnation. And I think that's where the real bottom line of it is. If you don't take your rights, if you don't say these are mine, fuck you, then when somebody tramples over them, you've got no one else to blame but yourself.
Right. The reality as far as rights or material goods or your life is that you only have what you're willing to earn for yourself, and then what you have the strength or the intelligence to defend. That if you don't have that ability within you, if you don't have those things within you, then you have nothing. That in the reality, you know, we have laws. We have these systems to create this illusion of safety, and it doesn't exist. You know, if somebody wants to come in and take your life, if they have the will to do so, they could accomplish that goal. And if you're not able to defend yourself, well, there's not really shit you can do about it. No law against you being murdered will prevent, you know, your death in that situation. So it just shows how, you know, what, you know, the bullshit behind the laws, the moral stances, the coded systems, things like that. It shows that it doesn't exist when put to the test, when applied to the fullest extreme, it all falls apart.
And that's precisely the problem. That's taking for granted or feeling that you're entitled to that right. You know, I don't think, you know, any rapist is going to stop if you turn around and say, hey, I've got equal rights with you now. The government says we're equal.
Right. Well, when you have to get your equality handed to you from on high, versus earning it, then are you really equal? You have to ask yourself that. When you go to your former masters and say, "I want equal rights," and your former masters say to you, "Okay, yeah, sure, buddy, we'll make you equal. You're equal now." Well, are you really equal? Because do you have the ability then to dole out equality to other people? No, you don't. You know, you don't have that within you. You don't have that power. You know, this idea of equality is an illusion. It's almost one of these part of this moral behavioral system. We're supposed to all treat each other equal. We're all supposed to see each other as equal. And the fact of the matter is, there's not a fucking person out there that's equal to me. And that is, and equal to me does not mean good, you know, better than me or worse than me or what have you. They're just not the same. Equality doesn't exist.
And that's exactly where I kind of draw the line in this whole thing too. Is just, you know, I know there's a guy out there that runs faster than me. I know that there's a guy out there that runs slower than me. I know there's a guy out there that maybe almost runs the same speed as me, but can't go quite as long as I can. You know, and there's always just that variation because it depends on the person's own commitment to themselves and not the acceptance of the external factors.
And then these different situations change. Your particular set of circumstances, depending on the moment, depending on the situation, may be best suited for that particular situation. And then depending on the frequency in which that situation occurs, that then determines how likely you're going to be successful in the long term versus other people. That's how evolution works, basically. The theory, I guess, of evolution is that, you know, if you are suited to a particular environment above and beyond those that are around you, then you have the greatest likelihood of passing on your particular traits to future generations, or that you should. Now, of course, we have a system where we've turned that on its ear, where we're encouraging the least of us to breed the most. We're encouraging those who have the least ability to survive on their own, the least, you know, ability to make do for themselves. We're encouraging them to profit, and we're encouraging them to go out and succeed. And that's when you've got a group of people, a government, that are saying to the people who are least likely to succeed, you deserve the most because you have the least ability to do for yourself. That's when you have a problem.
Yeah, I agree with that. It seems to me at that point that we're, we're going against our very nature.
Right. And I can say as far as theories are concerned, you know, I've long talked about how I don't agree with the idea that there's a shadow government or a shadow group, some sort of council or whatever that's making decisions about world events. I'm opposed to that idea, but I can sit there and say that there is a cultural pressure that the people who are at the very top, as far as capitalism is concerned, the people that are at the pinnacle of capitalism, being concerned about their position, being concerned about losing what few resources they have, they want to make sure that the middle class, the people that have the potential to advance, are always being opposed by or always in conflict with the lowest common denominator, the people that are least likely to advance. So it's the very wealthy telling the very poor that they deserve more and they should have lives like those people who have actually had the ambition to go out and earn it for themselves. So not necessarily lives like the people that live at the top of the mountain. Okay, that they're not, you know, they're not inviting people to their palaces. They're not inviting people to their parties. And when they talk about, you know, you should pay out more taxes and everything else, they're not writing more checks. Okay, they're saying to the people who do not earn shit that you should be equal to the people who actually work for a fucking living. So it's pitting one group of slaves, your most efficient group of slaves, against your least efficient group of slaves, keeping them both unhappy and keeping them both from turning against the actual slave masters.
Right. It works in my mind. I mean, wasn't that what Sun Tzu taught, to divide and conquer?
Right, right. And we are, unfortunately, on the receiving end of that. You know, we as a society have been divided and conquered, you know, and it's a matter of waking up to it.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of gone through this whole thing in my mind, and I still kind of like to point back to the fact that it seems like there's been this push to kind of disorganize what would be the traditional nuclear and extended families. And it seems that it's done to kind of work with this idea that we're putting forward right now of, you know, pitting the more productive with the least productive against each other. If you also mix up the, you know, if you mix up the sides, so not everybody's standing on the right end of the field, so to speak, what you've created is a hell of a lot of chaos to sort through before anybody even thinks of, you know, just dealing with that initial problem, the problem that, you know, the least productive are being pitted up against the most productive, let alone, again, like you said, you know, turning around and looking at the quote unquote hand that feeds. So, I mean, I think all of these things, morality in itself, which is, as far as I'm concerned, laws in themselves are just extensions of morals.
Right.
There's not a hard line that shows me that there's any one law that's made that doesn't have some form of morality attached to it, or it being developed because of it.
No, exactly. It's the idea of family that you're talking about. I kind of want to touch on that real quick. That I think that when you read the stuff by the Order of Nine Angles, the different information and ideas that they put out there, I mean, one of the things that they actually kind of reach back to is this idea of family, whether it's a clan or group or whatever it is they call it. The idea of finding people who are like you and then embracing them. Now, of course, they start the process by the individual really taking their own, you know, their own awareness and their own lives in their own hands and, you know, taking some serious risks. Performing some extreme tasks to discover who they are so that when they do find themselves in a family unit, an extended family type situation, they are, first of all, amongst peers who have experienced those same things, who've taken those same, you know, steps towards self-exploration. But then they've also, you know that every person in your family you can count on, you can rely on because, you know, there's no slackers basically. There's nobody that that isn't worth the effort, that isn't worth the connection. And what we see here is in our society, even a standard family, you know, mom, dad, and 2.3 kids or whatever it is, you want to divide those up. You want to make sure that those people feel as isolated as possible, that you want to not identify with your local group, with your particular community, with your, you know, with your family. You want to identify with the larger movements, the larger ideologies, the more ambiguous things, so that you don't have a clear definition to stand on. Because if you're identified that way, well, then it's easy to change that identification. You got all these people out there right now that call themselves Democrats and Republicans. Well, what is a Democrat and what is a Republican? Those ideas have changed, have gone from, you know, the 1960s, 1970s, the roles were almost reversed from what they are today. Or in the 50s and 40s, you know, it used to be that the Republicans were the champions of the poor, and the Democrats were the ones who, you know, were pushing the wealthy agenda. And now that has changed. The evolution has changed. But these people that have been voting since then, they still refer to themselves by those same titles. And whatever you're told a Democrat is, well, then that's what you believe you are. And that's not the way we should live. Those aren't the standards we should live by. We should start figuring out our own standards. And then living by those things.
Right on. And I think that brings us right back full circle to the idea of living life immorally.
Right. Right. And it's where you start questioning the values. You start questioning the things that are placed upon you, the ideas that you have, those urges that when you go out to do something, what prevents you from doing, you know, whatever, which in some cases, I guess when you start out exploring this idea, some of it means that you're going to do some things that would have the appearance of being immoral. You would do things that go against your moral code just to test and see if the particular moral value is also a rational value or not. So it's a matter of, you know, it's really challenging yourself. It's really making those determinations. But I guess, in my opinion, an amoralistic viewpoint is far superior to a moralistic viewpoint, because an amoralistic viewpoint is your viewpoint defined by your own experiences. A moralistic viewpoint just makes you safe and secure for the particular segment of the population you're trying to fit into, and limits you.
I would like to point out that being amoral is not necessarily something that you ultimately even define. Just as you were making the suggestion about the Democrats and the Republicans and the roles or what it means to be each thing having somehow evolved or mutated into its polar opposite, the same thing can happen with a value that you've determined to be there. I mean, every single day you could, eat an onion and you could go to the doctor and the doctor could say that onion is doing you a world of good. It's keeping you healthy or whatever. But there's that one day down the road when all of a sudden nature plays its little trick and you take a bite out of that onion only to discover that you now have a severe allergy to them. So the conditions of it change, and I think that's the most important thing about continuing on an amoral, in an amoral mindset, is that these values aren't hard, but rather something that you may look back and say, well, I've tested this before, and this is, what I've come up with. Would this situation be different?
Right. And there is no amoral system. The minute you have a system, the minute you have a code, you've got a moral code, not an amoral code. Amorality means not having morals. So exactly, the situation may change. And what experience has taught you is true may not be true for every situation. So it gives you flexibility, having an amoral viewpoint, the ability to evolve, the ability to adapt to whatever particular situation. Hell, going to war. Every person that I can think of, let's say most of the people, based on the society that we live in, you would assume that most people, before they joined the Army in World War II, were taught not to kill, were taught that killing was bad, that killing was an immoral act. And then, of course, they go to war, and they have to kill. Not only do they have to kill, but killing is a positive act. Killing these people that they don't know, who, are total strangers to them, who they don't know if they've committed a crime or not. They have no justification to kill the enemy other than they are the enemy. Yet they're told that it's a moral positive, it's a moral good. So the situation changed. And in that situation, morality was being used just to guide them, just to control them. And that just shows, it illustrates how invalid a moral code can be.
Right. I mean, I'm curious as to why, beyond a certain point, and I understand, during the early developmental phases, why some forms of control may be needed to help, kind of guide a person. But once you hit that, and I'm sorry, my phone's fucking up here, but once you hit that point where you are, in fact, a lucid being, I think those things should be pitched out. That I remember there being kind of this moment growing up where all of a sudden I woke up out of this daydream that I had been floating around in, and realized that, wait a minute, I'm a lucid being. I can make these decisions for myself. I can, choose which way to walk, which way to go, and. I mean, shit, well, maybe that's what's got me so angry ever since, is that I realized that I have that ability myself.
Well, I think that brings us back to the idea that, again, in our society, the vast majority of people live in a kind of quasi-adolescence, spiritually and intellectually, the remainder of their lives. I think everybody might reach a point, there might be that instance in some point in their development where they go, hey, I am free to do. I am, free to do as I will, to really explore my potential, to do whatever. And it seems like, again, I put this latest purely on social pressures and what have you, or just maybe inherent laziness in our species, but it seems like the vast majority of us choose to go, nah, I'd rather be told what to do. Nah, I'd rather have my decisions made for me. I'd rather be defined than defined for myself, that kind of thing. So I think there are very few self-actualized individuals walking around in our society right now. And the thing about self-actualization, I think, is that it's a constant effort that you never reach a point one day and go, oh, I'm self-actualized, no more work to do with this right now. Same with amorality. You know, it's not one day you go, okay, I'm tested. You know, okay, I've gone ahead and I no longer have any moral compulsions, so now I am amoral. It's something that it's a constant effort. It's a constant, challenge. And when people talk about the zest of life, when people talk about, vitality in every moment, I think that's part of that vitality, that every moment you recognize that I'm alive and things could change. I'm alive and it's an opportunity for me to be something else or do something different or to try. So, yeah, absolutely. It's that you need that lucid moment. And it's unfortunate that so many people make the decision not to stay in it.
Right. Well, it's almost like here's a good analogy, I guess, or a comparison that I can make to an experience that I've had. The first time I ever tripped on LSD, I wasn't the only person who was a first-time tripper. As a matter of fact, three out of the four guys that I was hanging out with were all getting ready to trip for the first time. And there was only one dude who had actually done this before. What I found was interesting is that myself being one of the three, I was the only one that when the trip really began to peak, when it really began to kick in, when there was just no turning back, I was the only one who went, woohoo, this is awesome, and just went with it. The other two started to freak themselves out and tried to do all kinds of things to bring themselves down. I remember actually wandering away from this group of guys because they had spent about an hour and a half drinking orange juice, fucking putting hot tea on their balls, just all these things that they'd heard would bring them down and out of their trip. And for me, it was that moment of, wow, a new experience that kept me going. It was exciting. It was titillating. It was maybe the equivalent of that lucid moment that I'm talking about.
Well, right, and I have to wonder if it has something, again, it's the coded behavior. Those guys, I mean, why take LSD? Why do that? If you're not interested in the trip, if you're not interested in experiencing and rolling with, good or bad, whatever's coming down and trying to break out of it. It just sounded like they were, they're playing chicken with themselves. They're playing chicken with the behaviors that have been trained into them, and they reached their limit. They took the LSD and then they started to trip and they reached their point. Whereas you, having self-actualization, realized that this was a new experience and you wanted to take full advantage of it. And you see that so often. People talk a lot of shit. So they talk big shit in life, right? But when you tell them, okay, let's put your chips on the table and see what happens, they back off. They're not interested.
No, they're not. Well, I'm just going to say this because, this is a good subject, but it's one that we could beat to death pretty quickly. We've got about 9 minutes left on the top of this hour. And the way I kind of figured, if we don't have somebody calling in within the next, 4 or 5 minutes or whatever, or somebody popping in the chat to offer up something I say because there are other things I'd rather talk about that we can't really discuss here on the air, that if something doesn't actually manifest further in this show, we go ahead and kill it early and discuss, you know, more, you know, what I would call necessarily more pressing issues.
Right on, right on. No, I totally agree with that. I was hoping with this idea, with, you know, talking about this, I was hoping that we'd get Tim's Hardcore in here, because if anybody's going to take a moral standpoint, it's going to be Tim. Getting Daryl in here, because I'd like to hear what his viewpoints are on amorality, would be. So maybe if they listen to the archive show, maybe this is something that we can pick up on next week. And I know that I knew bringing up the topic, you and I are going to pretty much agree across the board. So all we were going to be doing is citing examples of where amorality made more sense than morality. And yeah, and then, you know, there was just, you know, I was hoping there would be more people in the chat tonight, but it looks like the, for whatever reason, they're all what?
In turkey comas. Either that or they got beaten up on Black Friday.
Oh, man, there's some shit that went down on Black Friday. It just blows my mind. We don't go out and deal with that at all. You know, I'll pay the extra $200 not to have to be out there shopping.
Right on. I'm with you there, man. And these people are fucking nuts.
Yeah, you know, had I found myself in the situation where they're revealing the Xboxes at a fucking Walmart and somebody whips out pepper spray to clear the crowd, there would have been an ass beating. I would have been going to jail. Okay, whoever pulled that shit, you know, having experienced CS gas, you know, having hung out in the CS hut and screwed around with the newbies, pepper spray would not have been a problem, and there would have been an ass beating. That's just ridiculous. It just blows my mind. It just shows, you know, goes to show how well trained we are. People standing in line for hours to save themselves $20, you know. Or there was some woman talking about how she was sleeping in a parking lot for a week waiting to save like $100 or $200 on a television. It's like, you know what, if you went and found something to do with your time for that week that you were standing in line, you might have actually earned the jack to buy the television outright and not had to fuck with the line. But that kind of thinking makes too much goddamn sense, I think.
You know, it's funny. I was actually going to make an exact reference to that pepper spray incident. But since you took that, I'll take another pepper spray incident. I don't know if you saw the lady who lost her baby because the police department pepper sprayed her in the face during the Occupy movement. But that's kind of interesting too.
Yeah, that's just, I've seen, and that's actually, that ass clown, the cop that actually pulled that shit, he's become an icon, you know, and I wonder, you know, if he realizes that he's become the new poster boy for oppression. Just ridiculous. Just, you know, why you would do that, why you would, you know, feel the need to do those kinds of things, to pepper spray people for protesting, you know, not being violent or anything. They're just out there protesting. Hopefully, you know, this woman that lost her child will, you know, take some steps to, you know, make sure that her children in the future have no wants for money because they're taken care of by the city.
Shit, man. I would sue to have the city disabolished or abolished or something along those lines. I'm kind of screwing up my terminologies here, but that would be my goal. I wouldn't want money. I would want every single official that holds a chair that, you know, gave this guy the right to yield fucking pepper spray in any way, shape, or form. I want his ass out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, heads would have to roll. And it wouldn't just be the cop that pulled the shit. It'd be his superior officers. It would be the chief of police that allowed that kind of training to go on. It would be the mayor that condoned that particular program. The whole thing. But the issue with that is, you get a new mayor in there, you get a new chief of police, you get new cops and everything else, and they're going to follow the same program. There might be a different training now for the use of pepper spray, but eventually people that shouldn't have been sprayed are going to get sprayed in the face again, or they're going to get tasered, or they're going to get shot. That's just the way
right.
it is. My thing would be, hit the system where it hurts, their fucking pocketbook.
This is precisely why I'm saying that whatever government was involved in that should just be removed. Not replaced, removed.
Now that would be worth getting behind when they're talking about this pepper spraying incident resulting in a revolution, where the people rise up and go, yeah, we're not going to have this shit anymore. Police, chief of police, mayor and everything else, all that, city council, all that turns out to be bullshit. So all of you people are going to go away, and we're going to come up with a new form of government, whatever that might be. That would be amazing. If people started getting pissed off like these people in Egypt were pissed off, those poor bastards, they have this revolution. They have this, the first Occupy movement, if you will. They go into Cairo and everything else. They stand up there for their rights. They demand the government be toppled. They get the guy they want out, and then they're surprised when the guy that gets in, the person that they put in to just kind of help things, help smooth things over during the transition, the guy that gets in, he's being a little slow on the whole letting there be a vote. He's being a little slow on the, we'll get around to voting for an actual president later. The military, one of the generals that was in charge in the first place is now in charge. So they're back in Cairo getting shitty, and I think that's, that's what needs to happen. And this time, you take to the streets and you raise some hell, and you don't stop until you've got things working the way you want it to work.
Right, which ultimately most likely means you got to burn it all down to the ground, re-fucking till that ground, plant new seeds, and sit back and wait. You're going to have to do
exactly.
your time as a fucking fourth world country again.
Right. Or, you might not actually have to go back down to the point where you're a third world, a fourth world country again, where you're just broken and poor. But it means that you have to be, it would take some work, and it would take everybody. I mean, everybody would have to wake up and think, okay, today I am part of this new country, this new government, and I have responsibilities, and there will not be a day off for me for years, maybe, until we get this thing really up and running on its own. But still, you keep the technology, you use the technology, as a matter of fact, to accomplish your goals.
Right on. So we're almost at the top of the hour, dude, and everybody, like I said, is in some weird turkey coma. So, whatever, let's conclude this early, like I said. There are other things I think that would be more, beneficial for yourself and mine to discuss. So,
right on.
So, with all that being said and done, anything else you want to talk about real quick?
No, I got nothing.
All right. In that case, we'll catch all you fuckers next week.
Later.